Hey, everybody. Carolyn Ahrens here. Welcome to this podcast, our first book club exclusive podcast of this book club season. And if that weren't exciting enough, it's with Pete Gregg. Hi, Pete. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hi, Carolyn. Great to be with you.
I am loving your book, and all the early feedback is that it is really, really helping people. And right now, as people get this podcast, they're going to be reading chapters 3 and 4. So I want to ask you some specific questions about the first third of the book. But first, for people that are just getting to know you through this book, if they don't have much history with you, I wanted to ask a bit about your backstory, but because we're a book club and we're really nerdy and we just really like books a lot, I was wondering if you could give us your backstory in terms of the books you have written. Is this your fifth book?
I lose count. It's five or six. I can't remember. The first book I wrote, only about three people ever read it. And I'm mercifully, I don't know if it's available anymore. And I actually only agree with about half of it. So
really? You're not going to say what it's called?
No. I'm not even going to give you the title.
Wow.
I shared this story and someone managed to buy it for like 10 cents during the lecture. So then I wrote, what happened was when the 24/7 prayer movement started, and then my wife suddenly got incredibly sick, as you may know, I couldn't travel. I had no money. And yet all this incredible stuff was happening. And several publishers said, would you write down the story of what's happening with 24/7? And I didn't think anyone would read a book about a prayer movement. I thought that I wouldn't read a book about a prayer movement. That's a crazy thing to read a book about. But I just needed the money. I don't know, is that really ungodly? I just needed, they offered me money and I needed some. And also, more spiritually, there was a part of me that was bursting to share the stories, both the highs and the lows of what God was doing. And suddenly I didn't have any oxygen for that fire inside me, you know. So I found I really enjoyed the writing. So that was a book called Red Moon Rising that actually became a surprise bestseller. And I partnered with Relevant, it was the second book they ever published. And they pretty much had sold their cars to like fund the making of the book. And I remember saying to Cameron Strang, like, we're either going to go down together or, you know, fly. Then I wrote a book called The Vision and the Vow, which was based around a really call to discipleship, and a poem I wrote called The Vision that bizarrely went all around the world. I wrote just kind of like a manual for the 24/7 prayer room thing along the way. Then I wrote, it was God on Mute Next, which is all about unanswered prayer, counterintuitive response to a book about the previous book about answered prayer. Then I wrote Dirty Glory, which was the sequel to Red Moon Rising. It was kind of what's happening next with the 24/7 movement, and it was exploring the motif of the House of Prayer for the Nations thing. And then I wrote How to Pray. So I don't know how many that is, but
I lost count.
Yeah. There's a few.
I think it's six, maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're on six. We're on six. Yeah. I'm just writing the next one, which is going to be on how to hear God without kissing your brains goodbye.
Ah, love it. Love it. So how to pray, how do you see how to pray? Like, is it a natural progression from where you've been, or is it going back and setting the foundation? How do you see it in the continuity of what you've written about and explored?
If you think about it, it's crazy that, you know, we've been praying nonstop for 20 years, and I hadn't actually really sat down and thought about how do you actually do this? Mm. And I'm glad about that, because I think if I'd written a book on how to pray sooner, I think it would have maybe not been quite as balanced or quite as seasoned. I think maybe sometimes it takes a couple of decades to, you know, what do they talk about? The second naivete, passing through simplicity and complexity and then coming back to a place where you can write a simple guide for normal people. And what really, really surprised me, Carolyn, was that there's actually, I assume there was thousands of books on how to pray, and there's actually very few. There's lots of books about particular aspects of prayer. And I think the only other book that was even called How to Pray was a compilation of C.S. Lewis. So I figured that's pretty good company right there.
Not bad.
And then, I think I say it in the foreword, but when I asked Nikki Gumbel, the pioneer of Alpha, would you write the foreword? He said, "I'm so glad you're going to call it How to Pray." And then he said this thing about, in his Bible in 1 year devotional that has a gazillion uses, the most downloaded day every single year is the one entitled How to Pray. So this is the question people are asking. And you stop and think for a single second, you realize, yeah, that's kind of the key to everything. So I'm glad I didn't write it sooner, although a little surprised that I didn't. I'd written memoirs. I'd written books about how prayer doesn't work. But I haven't actually written one just on, here you go, stupid. Here's how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're glad you've written it now. And it seems like now is the right time. One more question about your biblio autobiography before we dive specifically into this book. And that's Red Moon Rising, about the power of prayer, God on Mute, about when God doesn't seem to be answering prayer. How do you see those two books? Do you see them in an arm wrestle? Do you see one exegeting the other? How do you see them interacting?
No, I see them integrally connected. It's interesting. When I wrote the book about unanswered prayer, I had one famous leader sat me down and said, "Please don't write that book because you're meant to be the guy who tells us this stuff works." But I just see it the complete opposite. I think to talk about unanswered prayer is a sign of faith, not unbelief. If an atheist's prayers don't get answered, it doesn't cause them a crisis of faith. They right. just go, that's because there isn't a God. To wrestle with unanswered prayer is a sign of faith, and often it's a sign of deepening faith. And I deeply and profoundly believe we have no right to talk about the miracles God does do unless we're as honest as the Bible is about the miracles he doesn't do. And I don't think that God is just in the nice stuff. I think God is in the shadows. He's the light, but he's in the shadows. And there is a complexity and even almost a darkness about the goodness of God that that needs exploration and will be deeply familiar to anyone who's been a Christian for more than about 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you say a couple times in the book that the Bible is more honest about unanswered prayer than the church. And
isn't that crazy?
But the honesty is not just so helpful.
It's not just a non sequitur. The thing is, if the church isn't honest, what are we? Some kind of casting list? Are we some kind of museum? We've got to be a place for people whose hearts are broken, who are struggling, who are questioning. And so it's really, I'm so passionate that we must be more honest and create cultures of greater honesty in order to include those who are hurting the most the way Jesus did.
Really helpful. All right. Can I ask you some of my specific questions from reading the book? It's so fun to be the director of the book club because I just get to ask what I'm curious about. In chapter 3, you have this sentence. So just to refresh people's memories, chapter 1, you're arguing for the universality of prayer, that is kind of a native language, the importance of specific places of prayer, which has me thinking about where I most like to pray. Chapter 2, you've got this just wonderful, keep it simple, keep it real, keep it up. So, so helpful. Chapter 3, you start coaching us on the deep need for stillness, for order, for what you call freedom from ultimate responsibility. And there's this sentence caught my eye. You said, "He has designed us to live humbly, seasonally, and at peace." And the word I wasn't expecting was seasonally. And I was just wondering if you could unpack that a bit more, what you mean when you say we're built to live seasonally.
Yeah, I just don't think God is into genetic modification of crops. I think there are times in all our lives of enormous fruitfulness, and there are times of death. I say in the front, we've just released God on Mute, and the quote that I put right on the front page is by Samuel Rutherford. He wrote it. He was a Puritan. He wrote it when he was imprisoned, or he'd been exiled to I think it was Aberdeen in Scotland, and he said, "Grace groweth best in winter." Isn't that great? Grace groweth best in winter, and that's why we actually, the device for the cover of the new edition of God on Mute is a winter tree. And if you don't have a good cold, hard winter, you're not going to have a good spring, right? You're not going to have a good harvest. We have to push into the seasons of life and stop expecting that God is on this kind of continuum and always behaves the same way with us and for us. And we're not good at that, are we? We're not good at humbling ourselves and even mortifying ourselves into participation in creation. We hide corpses. It's extraordinary. People die all the time. We don't even see, we don't want to see that stuff. We old people try to look like young people. We're a culture that is in profound denial of aging. We have electric lights and central heating and air conditioning, so we can all the time eliminate the extremes of the seasons of life. I don't believe that's necessarily healthy. Certainly, it's not spiritually healthy. So, yeah, I think we have to live seasonally. And one of the keys to maturity is to ask, what season am I in? And the other interesting thing is the stormiest moments in the year, if you live anywhere where there's more than one season, is when one season is turning into the other, right? When summer is becoming winter, the fall. Bang, those sunsets, those storms. When winter is turning to summer, spring, you get the Chinooks and all this stuff. And there's something about the liminality of moving between seasons that are times where our choices are disproportionately important. So if you are in a season of change, a season of transition from one season to the next, those times are more significant in your life than others. We tend to think every day is the same. It's not. There are times where we are just plodding on. And then there are seasons where it's like, bang, God's speaking, everything's changing. And the choices you make will set the trajectory for the next few months or even years.
That makes me think, though, that on those plodding on days, those might be important. Dulce Willard had this idea that it's what you do off the spot that prepares you for when you're on the spot. So even the seasonality makes me want to also be very daily, right? So that winter doesn't catch me by surprise with no muscle, no equipment,
100%. Actually, when you get to the intense times of transition, it's almost, you're just almost reacting. And so the times where you have the luxury to dive in, to do things like the Renovare Book Club, actually, these are times to gather stones, as Ecclesiastes says. These are times to fill your bag with seeds for sowing. These are times to push in deep, take initiative in discipling relationships and so on. So don't waste, it's the grace of God that he doesn't engage with us at a sort of hyperactive ADHD level. Thank God there are times. My friend Tim Hughes, I think I put this in the book, he says, God only has two speeds, slowly and suddenly. Mm-hmm. And even when he does things suddenly, he takes his time. Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you do anything environmentally to lean into the seasons? Like, yeah. I totally grasp it as a metaphor for the ebb and flow and the undulation of our spiritual lives. But do you make your house cold in winter? I hope you don't, because my husband will take this as fuel for his turning the thermostat down fire. But do you actually try to avoid engineering out seasonality of your physical environment?
yeah, my year is highly seasonal, and that is fundamental to my spirituality. In a way, I'm fortunate. When you live in the UK, you have all four seasons. I'm aware, you know, if you're in Hawaii or somewhere, I'm sure you have other upsides, but you know, it's the same every day. So right now, actually, I spent a good chunk of time over recent weeks chopping logs, preparing for fires. We lighting fires becomes a big part of our life, and the gathering around of fires. I changed my diet seasonally, actually.
Really?
I fancy different kinds of foods. And I find, forgive me, this is very subjective and highly personal, but I'm much more creative when the weather is stormy or whatever. I become massively superficial when it's bright sunshine. How the Romans ever conquered the world, I don't know, because these days they just eat pasta and ride Vespa motorbikes. You know, they're just the most chilled people because of the climate.
Right.
But most of the people who built empires were just like, they live in cold, miserable places like England. And so they go out and conquer hot, sunny places. But yeah, my spirituality is definitely linked heavily to the seasons. And I'm very, you know, I love the Celtic spiritual tradition, which is deeply holistic. One of my favorite Celtic prayers is, I make this bed in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, that doesn't see this dualism between the physical realities of life, the food we eat, the exercise we take, the chores that we undertake, and our encounter with God.
Yeah, that's great. Do you see the church calendar playing a role in terms of living seasonally?
Yeah. Again, that is increasingly important to me. And, you know, my background is free church, non-denominational, although we work closely with, you know, the Catholic Church at the highest levels, the Anglican Church at the highest levels, and so on. And I deeply value those traditions, although many of them can't agree on the church calendar, but that's another issue. But I think what I realized is that those seasons in the church calendar don't just belong to certain types of Christians called liturgical. They belong to everybody. And, you know, the free church non-denominational tradition is 2,000 years old. That's probably another conversation for another time, but we can go back to Antioch rather than Jerusalem and have that conversation sometime. And so I believe that liturgy and seasons in our ecclesiology belong to all Christians. And that's part of not being genetically modified, right? You know, Lent is a season where with 2 billion others, we push into the wilderness, into the wilds, and that gorgeous Advent journey, you know, knowing that you're undertaking it with millions of others. I think there's a violence in that says it's not just do I feel this or what do I want to pray about right now. I am part of a tradition that's older and bigger than me.
Yeah, love it. All right, well, now that you've brought up different church expressions, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your mention of speaking in tongues, which shows up in a couple places of the book. And I read the prayer toolshed guide on speaking in tongues, and you're really commending it as a gift for everyone. And I just wanted to ask, do you think, my own understanding has been, it's a gift given to some and not others for the benefit of the community. So help me with that. Is it, do you know people who have vibrant prayer lives who don't speak in tongues? How important do you think speaking in tongues is?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Apostle Paul, as you know, in 1 Corinthians, on one hand, he says, you know, for example, prophecy, he says, is way more important than speaking in tongues.
Right.
And then he says, and love is more important than everything.
Any of it, yeah.
But he also says, but I speak in tongues more than all of you. So what tends to happen is the Pentecostals quote that bit, and then the you know, the non-charismatic Pentecostals quote the other bit about, oh, tongues isn't that important. And I just think it's part of the toolkit. And, you know, I do believe it's available to all Christians. And, you know, whether you frame it as precognitive speech or whether you frame it as something a little more mystical than that, the Apostle Paul says that by speaking in tongues, we are edified. And I often, when I don't really know what to do or don't know how to pray, find the gift of tongues helps me. Dallas Willard talks a lot about one of the ways to hear God is to, you know, ask him to speak, but then go and do some gardening or go and do something, mm-hmm. you know, that switches into a different bit of your brain. I think tongues is part of that. And also, this is something we'll come on to later in the book, I think the charismatic and contemplative traditions are basically the same thing.
Yeah.
And yet they tend to have been positioned at opposite ends of the spectrum. But it's interesting, John Wimber was a Quaker. You know, that's why Vineyard churches, when people respond to receive prayer, they open their hands and go quiet. It's a Quaker thing, you know. You know, Richard Rohr has got more in common with, you know, with John Wimber than you might think, because both are about how do we encounter the presence of God, the love of God, get caught up in the love of God in a way that is beyond rational process and beyond just words. So, yeah. And you're right, in the toolkit that's at prayercourse.org that links to the How to Pray book, you'll find articles on lots of different aspects of prayer, and one of them is speaking in tongues. And I'll say this as well. I find, to those who listen to this in North America, I find there's a very different perception in North America than there is in most parts of the world. In North America, there's historically, it's reducing, it's still there, it's colossal sort of social marker, tribal division between whether you're sort of, you know, evangelical slash the word slash liturgical, and whether you're charismatic Pentecostal. It's just almost unique to America. But Americans really don't realize that. They think that's the whole world. So like the biggest tongues speakers in the world are probably the Catholic Church. Yeah, there's at least 124 million what they would call renewed Catholics. That would be spirit baptized, Jesus loving, Bible. I mean, they're not part of Pentecostal churches. They're mass taking Catholics. And so I actually one of the great gifts of the charismatic renewal hasn't been the rediscovery of the gifts of the Spirit, because those never went away. Richard Foster talks very openly about all of those in his books. It's been the circuit board. The charismatic renewal has created a lingua franca, you know, Roman roads, a circuit board for Christian unity. Hmm. And generally speaking, when you find Catholics working together with Lutherans, working together with Methodists, the common thread is often some kind of renewal through the Holy Spirit.
That makes sense to me. Yeah, I have to say, when I first started hanging out with the Renovare folks, like went to the first Renovare ministry team retreat, one of the things that really struck me was how charismatic gifts were just taken for granted in a completely non-flashy way that I really hadn't experienced. I'm in Canada, but yeah, here in North America, we were a little more tribal about that. So to just see it kind of woven in with everything else was exciting. Mm-hmm. And I will just confirm what you're saying. In the Renovare Institute, I've noticed when we're teaching students Lectio Divina and kind of Ignatian style meditation, things like that, it's always the charismatics who get it first, even though they've never heard of these terms before. And they might be a little suspicious of some of those Latin terms. They are have the easiest time entering into it. So I affirm what you are saying. Well, we're still in this section about pausing, centering. I love the bit about kinetic centering. My husband is a mountain biker, and that's how he prays. He's got to sweat it out. And he also says that one of the reasons he loves mountain biking so much is he finds he and his guy friends have to get exhausted before they can actually communicate. Like something happens in their bodies when they get exhausted, where some kind of guard drops and they're able to talk to each other. And I think for him, it's the same with him and God. So I love that you included that. I wanted to ask you, sometimes you will hear, so you talk about the brain protein that's released when you exercise and how that can open you up, and the thought of Jesus, you know, kind of doing that body hack in his prayer with God. With the Father, I love that. What I wanted to ask you is, you will sometimes hear people dismiss deep prayer experiences or ecstatic experiences as nothing but a flood of hormones. And so I just want you to speak to that, God using our physiological processes, but also how do we distinguish that from maybe other potentially fraudulent ecstatic experiences or maybe not fraudulent, but not Christ-centered ecstatic experiences. Just talk about the body and prayer.
Yeah, great question. But I think it's essential. We've touched on this already by talking about seasons and a holistic spirituality. But, you know, God gave us bodies. And so our prayer lives, you know, are incarnated. You know, Jesus didn't send an email. He came. It's so interesting, isn't it, that, you know, as I say in the book, you know, when he's climbing a mountain to pray, what if that was just a little bit like your husband getting out on a mountain bike? We always assume, I don't know, it was like he liked the view or he was trying to get away. But what if that was just part of his spirituality?
And that's
a very Jewish way of thinking that, you know, God is in, you know, there's a whole book of the Bible about the spirituality of sex. I mean, this is the glory of the Judeo-Christian tradition that, you know, God is in the elements. When Jesus gives us the holy meal, it's just the stuff that was on the table. It's the bread and the wine. So extend that theology, which isn't just good theology, it's really the only Christian theology to think that way, to what does that mean for my body? What is that? How do I pray not just in words, but with all of my strength and all of my mind and all of my heart? And I also would want to slightly push back on people who say things like what you just said about, you know, is being wary of experiences, because just think about it philosophically, everything is experience. I mean, if you sit there reading a book, thinking profound thoughts, that is being filtered through a set of neural pathways, and the way you read the words on the page is influenced by your own experiences and your own context. And so what we have to do is not try and eliminate experience and even the mystical aspects of everyone's experience, but how do we navigate those in a way where we have some discernment of, you know, bluntly, what is the world, what is the flesh, what is the devil, and what is the Holy Spirit? And I think a lot of, you know, obviously, if it's the devil, it's not good. but there is some things that are the flesh that are just neutral, you know. And if I can posture myself in a certain way that means I am more peaceful or more able to receive from God, then shouldn't I do that? So I'm not going to say do exercise, you then, you know, get, you know, all sorts of chemicals released and that is somehow God. I'm just saying if those experiences position you to receive from God, that's in line with what Henri Nouwen says, that is about spiritual disciplines are the effort that we exert in order to open our hands to receive from God. So I find this very, very exciting. Now, inevitably, some people will be more driven by the intellect and some people more driven by the heart and by mysticism. And I think we need one another, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. All right, we'll wrap this first podcast up in a minute, but I just wanted to ask you, I was going to say I have one more question, but I have two for this section. One has to do with, you close chapter 3, your exemplar there is the desert mothers and fathers, which I love. And you talk about how, you know, once Christianity became the dominant religion and there was this kind of shift in power, the culture became toxic. And it made me want to ask you, as you have traveled around the world, does prayer look differently in places where Christianity doesn't have the political, cultural power, doesn't have the majority, then it looks in places where maybe there's oppression or Christians are the underdog.
Well, Karen, you're Canadian, I'm British, but we're all aware that I think President Trump and Joe Biden had a little discussion, didn't they, a few days ago?
They did indeed.
And yes. It seems to me that if you are American, trying to know how to pray around those things is quite complex right now. And so I think there is a complexity when Christianity doesn't just carry authority, as it always does in the culture, but attains power. And we have to think very, very carefully about how to handle that power. And one of my questions for some of my US friends, who probably quite rightly make a big deal of, you know, the church doesn't interfere in politics. The trouble is, if there's no recognition of the church's power, then you have a sort of deregulated sort of lobby, which can get co-opted by one side or the other. Moving on very swiftly from that before I get into trouble. You know, obviously, I mean, we do a lot. We have many friends in Iran and Persian world, which is the fastest growing church on earth right now.
Really?
But most of them have been in and out of prison. We have members of our own church here in the UK who can't go back to Iran now. They've eventually had to spread their wings, leave Iran because it's too dangerous. And, you know, their stories are utterly humbling. You know, I talked to a guy called Fashid, who, you know, effectively chose to let them arrest him. He was going to run away. He was going to escape the police. And then he realized, you know, the good shepherd laid down his life for the flock, and he was a pastor, and he went and basically handed himself in. And he was then separated from his children for years and years. And he was in solitary confinement. But when he talks, you know, he says, you know, he said, I felt angry with God. But then he said, I began to realize when I was on the outside, I was constantly in fear of what the authorities would say. But now they have given me a prayer room where no one can interfere with me. And he said, the Holy Spirit came through all those locked doors and met with me and filled me with such joy. I would just dance in my cell. And the guards would say, I don't understand. Why are you the happy one? And I'm the sad one. And I mean, their stories are extraordinary. And so I think, of course, you pray differently. You'll have seen this, I'm sure, Karen, in your travels. But when you get out of the wealthy parts of the world, the less people have in terms of money and security, the more alive they often are spiritually. Yeah. And the richer and more comfortable people are, often the more dull they are spiritually. And again, this is why we need a conversation, not just within the Western world, but with the whole global communion of saints.
This is truth. My last question on this section is actually just a curiosity question. In chapter 4, you do talk about the gift of liturgy alongside more spontaneous forms of worship. And you mentioned that you belong to a religious order called the Order of the Mustard Seed. I know Jill Weber a little bit, so I've heard a little bit about this. Can you just say a little bit more about what that is and why you're part of it?
Yeah. The Order of the Mustard Seed is a religious order that goes back to the 18th century. It was founded by Count Ludwig Nikolaus von Zinzendorf and his friends when they were at the University of Wittenberg, or Hall Academy, it's one of those two. And we take a simple vow to do three things: to be true to Christ, to be kind to people, that's the one I fail on most days, and to play our part in taking the gospel to the nations. Most people either wear a ring or have a tattoo on their skin somewhere. Again, this goes right back to the early 18th century in Zinzendorf, where they wore a ring that said, no man liveth unto himself. In the Greek, wonderfully, that's not gender specific. No person lives for themselves. And So it's growing very fast. Jill is the global convener of the order. now and is doing a brilliant job. We're officially acknowledged by the House of Anglican Bishops. And we had some really fun conversations with various abbots and bishops in that process. One of them was, you know, they were saying, do you think, you know, should it be life vows or shouldn't we do annual renewal of the vows? And you know, we said, well, so many people are having them tattooed on them. How is that not for life? And this abbot just almost fell off his seat. We've never had to deal with that in two millennia of monasticism. So that's the order. And it's for me, it gives a boundedness to the chaos. And it reminds me that my faith is a covenant. It's not just a convenience. And it just gives me a rule of life, a framework for living amidst all the sort of hyperbole and, you know, all the metaphors we drown in often in Christianity. And you just say, what does this really mean in practice? And I have an answer to that because, you know, we break those three vows down into two practices, each of six practices. So true to Christ, we express very practically through a commitment to prayer and worship and a commitment to creativity. We express kindness to people through two commitments, one to hospitality and the other one to justice and mercy. And then the third vow, which is to take the gospel to the nations, we express that in two very practical ways. One is a commitment to evangelism, not just vague mission, but telling people about Jesus. And the other is a commitment to learning, because in line with Leslie Newbig and others, we believe that learning belongs in the context of mission. If you train to be a brain surgeon, it's part of the Missio Dei. So I have six practices, and I audit my life, and I'm always failing at one or two of them, but it gives me a shape. And I respect people deeply who don't feel the need to take those kind of vows. It's my weakness and my stupidity that means I find it helpful to have that framing and that discipline at the heart of my existence. And we're mostly a lay-led dispersed order, but we increasingly have got some actual residential communities. And Jill is actually now just opening a new monastery on a 1400-year-old monastic site here in the UK.
Amazing. Are there people all over the world, or is it primarily in the UK? Or
No, it's very all continents. And someone said to me recently, he said, he's an Anglican bishop, he said, I think you're the fastest growing religious order in the world, which I found very encouraging until I realized what the competition was. Most of them are declining fast. So don't be too impressed by that. But, you know, we have, it takes a year of preparation before we'll sort of allow people, as it were, to take their vows. You know, Jill would know the numbers, but we always have well over 100 people, normally from all five continents, who are in preparation at any given time.
Very cool. And if someone's listening to this and feeling a little tug on their heart, how would they find out more?
Just go to either just Google Order of the Mustard Seed, or I think the URL is mustardseedorder.org.
Something. Okay, we'll find it. We'll post it alongside.
It's on there. You'll find it. You'll find it. And it's one of the more controversial things we do. People get terribly worried about Freemasonry and promising and secrets. But this has been at the heart of Christian faith always. And it's you don't get a much more wonderful conspiracy than people ganging up to be true to Jesus, try to be kind to people, and to take the gospel to the ends of the earth.
Yeah, that's beautiful. We have a little fledgling thing in that direction called the Fellowship of the Burning Heart at Renovari. So we can be a beautiful. little sibling to the mustard seed, but
I'm
wonderful.
Sure we have a lot to learn.
Well, thank you for this conversation. I know people will be very much looking forward to our second podcast, so we'll resume that soon. Talk to you soon.